A new feeling, more powerful even than my rage and fear, filled my heart. I loved Rhea, loved her spirit, her vitality. "You are all that you are," she had said to me once. Then the words of the Grand Elusa, spoken within her glowing crystal cave, came back to me. "The last treasure carries great powers, greater than you know." My powers were my own, to fear, perhaps, but also to use. The goblin's powerful shoulders tensed for the blow. Trouble screeched again, fighting to free himself from the Gulliant's grip. "But what about my promise?" Again I heard Rhea's voice. "If someone gave you special powers, they are for you to use." My mother, her sapphire eyes piercing into my soul, joined in. "All God asks is that you use your powers well, with wisdom and love." Love, not rage. That was the key. The same love that caused the Galator to glow. The same love for Rhea that filled me now.
"Make your move," commanded the voice of Damnu. "In chess, as in life, your choice will make all the difference."
Just as the warrior goblin started to bring down his sword on Rhea's head, I focused all of my concentration on the great sword Deeper Cut, suspended from the wall just behind the throne. The flames rose again in my mind, but I persisted, pushing them back. Beyond the gleeful snort of the goblin, I heard nothing. Beyond the sword and the iron hook that held it, I saw nothing.
"Fly, Deeper Cut, fly!"
The iron hook burst apart. The sword, ripped free of the wall, flew toward the goblin. Hearing it slice through the air, he turned. Half a second later, his severed head rolled onto the stone floor. Rhea screamed as the heavy body fell on top of her. Stangmar roared in anger, his face a mass of shadows. The two red-robed men cried out and stepped back in fright. Only the Gulliants, their faces utterly blank, stood watching in silence. In the commotion, I let go of my staff and raised my hands high. Deeper Cut spun through the air toward me. With both hands, I seized the silver hilt. The Gulliants, seeing this, drew their own swords. Moving as a single body, they rushed at me. Suddenly, the voice of the king rang out. "Stop!" His downturned lips released a long, low snarl.
"This duel is ours, no one else's."
The shadows roiled across his body. For an instant, he hesitated. Then, with a violent shake, he declared to someone only he could see,
"We said this duel is ours. We need no help."
Bounding down from the throne, he swiftly retrieved the sword of the fallen warrior goblin. Glowering at me, he slashed his blade through the air. Only then did I notice that the shadows had again departed from his face. Stranger yet, when I glanced at the red throne, the dark shadows were still there, hovering just above the seat. I felt gripped by the feeling that somehow those shadows were watching me closely.
"So," he taunted, "you have the powers, do you? Just like your grandfather before you." He took a pace toward me. "But even with all his powers, your grandfather could not escape a mortal death, nor will you."
I barely had time to lift Deeper Cut to block Stangmar's first swipe. The swords clanged, echoing among the stone arches of the hall. The force of his blow made my sword vibrate down to the hilt. My hands strained to hold on. I realized that Stangmar had the triple advantages of greater strength, more skill, and, even with my improved vision, better eyesight. Despite all this, I fought back as well as I could. Although the spinning floor and its constant vibration threw off my balance, I pressed the attack. Slashing wildly, I parried and dodged. Sparks flew when our blades clashed. Perhaps my sheer ferocity made Stangmar cautious. Perhaps Deeper Cut itself somehow strengthened me. Or perhaps Stangmar was merely toying with his prey. Whatever the reason, it seemed as we worked our way up and down the hall studded with precious objects that I was actually holding my own. All of a sudden, Stangmar drove down on me. With a powerful blow that rang through the hall, he smashed into Deeper Cut. The sword ripped from my hands and clattered to the stone floor. The king brought his sword to my throat.
"Now we shall keep our promise." He indicated the terrible cauldron by the wall. Go.
Still panting, I stood my ground.
Who made you promise to kill me?
Go.
And why should that promise mean so much to you, when you've broken all of your promises to your own people?
Go.
I folded my arms.
You promised Rita Gower, didn't you?
Stangmar's frown hardened, even as the shadows danced over the throne.
Yes. And you would be wise to speak of our good friend with respect. Now go!
I looked imploringly at the man whose eyes and hair mirrored my own.
Can't you see what Rita Gower has done to you? To your realm? He wants you to poison your lands, blacken your sky, terrify your people, and even kill your own son.
As I spoke, the mysterious shadows thrashed wildly on the throne.
Stangmar's face reddened. You have no understanding of these things, no understanding at all.
He pushed the tip of the sword against my neck. With difficulty, I swallowed.
Rita Gower is not your friend. He is your master, and you are his slave.
Eyes aflame, he prodded me toward the cauldron.
Would Elend, your wife, my mother, want this?
Stangmar's rage boiled over.
We will spare the cauldron and strike you down with this very sword.
With that, he lifted his weapon to whack off my head. Seeing my opening, I concentrated on Deepercut, lying on the floor just behind him.
To me, Deepercut, to me!
But I was too late. The sword had only just begun to move, tilting up on one edge, when the Grim King planted his feet firmly to deliver the blow. As his rear foot came down, however, it grazed the upturned blade of Deepercut. The black edge, with the power to slice deep into the soul, pierced his leather boot and pricked the base of his heel. Stangmar cried in agony and crumpled to the ground. The shadows flailed, seeming to shake the very throne. The Gulliant, swords drawn, started to come to the king's aid, but he raised his hand. Abruptly, the soldiers halted. Slowly, Stangmar lifted his head. He gazed up at me, his face growing softer by the second. His jaw loosened, his eyes widened. Only the frown did not change.
You spoke the truth, he declared, speaking with difficulty. We, that is, I, confound this royal speech. I am no more than a slave.
The throne rocked violently from side to side. Stangmar turned to the thrashing shadows.
You know it is true, he cried. I am nothing more than your lowly puppet. My head is now so filled with your threats and delusions that it spins as incessantly as this cursed castle.
At that, a chilling, hissing sound arose from the shadows. They ceased their wild movements and started shrinking, congealing into something still darker. The king struggled to stand, but the wound had made his whole lower body immobile, and he fell back. Somberly, he faced me again.
You must understand. It was never our, that is, my, intention that Finkaira should come to this. When I made that first promise, I had no idea what grief it would bring.
Why?
I demanded.
Why did you ever make a promise to Rita Gower?
Stangmar's brow furrowed.
I did it to save Elen.
Elen? My mother?
All at once I remembered her final words about my father.
If ever you should meet him, remember, he is not what he may seem.
Yes, Elen of the Sapphire Eyes.
He took a deep breath and exhaled very slowly, his elbows propped against the stone floor.
When she gave birth to you on the shores of Finkaira, it broke one of our oldest laws, one handed down by the spirits themselves, that no one with human blood should ever be born here. Otherwise, humans would have a birthright to a world that is not their own. The punishment for this high crime has always been harsh, but clear. The half-human child must be exiled forever from Finkaira, and what is worse, the human parent must be thrown into the cauldron of death.
He tried again to stand, with no success. The Gouliants, who appeared increasingly agitated, started toward him again. The Gouliant holding trouble joined with the others, his sword in one hand and the struggling hawk in the other.
"Stop!" ordered Stangmar. "I do not need your miserable help."
The Gouliants obeyed, though they continued to watch, warily fidgeting with their swords. Meanwhile, the shadows on the throne continued to shrink. As they condensed, they grew thicker and darker, like the center of a gathering storm. Stangmar shook his head.
"I did not know what to do. How could I condemn to death my own fairy land? She lifted me higher than the trees I once climbed as a child. Yet I was the king, the one responsible for enforcing the laws. Then Rita Gower first came to me. He offered me his help, in exchange for my help in solving a problem of his own."
"What problem was that?"
Stangmar looked away.
"Rita Gower told me that he had learned in a dream that his gravest danger would come from a child who is half human and half Enkairan. So, knowing of you, he believed that as long as you lived, you would pose some sort of threat to him."
My whole body trembled, even apart from the quaking of the floor.
"So you agreed to kill me instead of her?"
"I had no choice, don't you see? Rita Gower promised to protect Elan and all of Finkaira from any punishment by the spirits for this violation of the law."
"And you promised to throw me in the cauldron?"
"I did. Sometime before the end of your 7th year. For that entire time, I kept my promise a secret from Elan. I only told her that the spirits had agreed that she need not die, and you need not be exiled. She was so relieved. I could not bear to tell her the truth. She trusted me completely."
His voice took on a faraway tone.
"As it happened, during that 7 years, the alliance with Rita Gower grew more and more strong and necessary. He alerted me to the giant's plot to overrun Finkaira. He helped me to cleanse our land of dangerous enemies. He gave me a castle where I could be truly safe. He..."
The words trailed off as the king slumped lower.
"He made me his slave."
Touched by his anguish, I completed the story for him.
"And when Elan, my mother, found out that she had been spared only so that I could die, she fled Finkaira, taking me with her."
Stangmar gazed at me in despair.
"So in the end, I lost you both."
"And so much more,"
added Hrea, standing next to the corpse of the beheaded warrior goblin. I nodded, then turned to the Gouliants. For some reason, they had drawn closer about the throne, surrounding it with their bodies. Yet despite the nearness of the other soldiers, Trouble continued to wriggle and flap his wings fiercely. The Gouliant who held him did not seem to notice that one of the hawk's talons had almost pulled free.
"Too true," admitted Stangmar. "Rita Gower has assured me that if I can find my half-human son and put him to death, my power will then be complete. But what he really means is that I will have done his bidding, ridding him of whatever threat you might represent. So who, I ask, is ruler now?"
At that instant, the Gouliant stepped in unison away from the red throne. Parting like two curtains, they revealed an impenetrable knot of blackness, writhing on the seat. Darker than the shroud itself, the shifting knot released a shrill, shrieking hiss. With the sound came an icy gust that chilled me to the marrow of my bones.
"Rita Gower!"
shouted Stangmar, desperately trying to raise himself off the floor. The knot of darkness leaped off the throne, flew past Rhea, and landed on the floor next to Deepercut. Before I could even take a breath, it wrapped itself completely around the silver hilt. Like a dark hand of evil, it raised the sword and slashed at Stangmar, slicing one side of his face from ear to chin. Blood streaming down his jaw, the king howled in pain and rolled to the side. Suddenly, Stangmar froze. His expression began to change from terror to wrath. His eyes narrowed, his frown tightened, his fists clenched so hard they went white. Then, to my shock, he grabbed the other sword and jumped to his feet. He stood beside me, proud and strong, despite his bloody face.
"Help us!"
I cried. But instead of aiming his sword at the black knot holding Deepakut, he pointed it straight at me.
"You are a fool, boy. We are not so easily defeated as that."
I backed away.
"But you said..."
"We said nothing of importance," he declared, with a wave toward the undulating mass of darkness that was Rita Gower. "Our friend here has healed us. By striking us with the edge that can heal any wound, he has cured our whimpering soul, and in doing so he has brought us back to our senses. We know who our enemies are, and now we will strike you down."
Rhea started to charge at the king, but two of the Ghoulians stepped in front of her. She tried her best to dodge them, but they blocked her path. As Stangmar drew back his sword, preparing to run me through, Rita Gower gave another shrieking hiss. Stangmar faltered. Slowly, he lowered his weapon. Looking somewhat ashamed, the king shook his head.
"We would not fail you again," he protested. "We were deceived, deluded. Allow us to fulfill our promise to you now."
An angry, ear-splitting hiss was Rita Gower's only answer. As Stangmar looked on obediently, the pulsing knot of darkness lifted its own sword once again. Swinging the blade around, Rita Gower prepared to end my life. Just then, another shrill cry filled the hall. Trouble had finally broken free from the Ghoulian's grip. As the soldier tried in vain to pierce the hawk with his sword, Trouble soared toward the ceiling of the great hall. Swooping up to the highest possible point, the Merlin released a screech that echoed from every wall. He careened sharply in the air, pausing for a split second above our heads. Then this small but spirited creature, whose life ever since our first meeting had consisted of one brave deed after another, did the bravest deed of all. At the very instant that the sword started slicing toward me, Trouble beat his wings mightily and plunged faster than an arrow into the very center of the black mass. Taken by surprise, Rita Gower let go of the sword, which flew across the hall, skittering over the stones. As the cold arms of blackness wrapped around Trouble, he slashed and pecked and whipped his wings furiously. Hissing and screeching, the dark knot and the Merlin rolled over each other on the floor. Desperately, I searched for some way to help Trouble, but how? I could try wielding Deepakut, but he and Rita Gower had embraced each other so tightly that I couldn't possibly hit one without hitting the other. I could try using my powers to strike a different kind of blow, but that would surely fail for the same reason. My heart burst to watch, yet that was all I could do. Trouble fought on valiantly. Still, Rita Gower's chilling embrace and superior strength proved too much. Slowly, inexorably, the mass of darkness was swallowing the bird, consuming him bit by bit. First his talon, then his wing, then half of his tail, and in a few more seconds, his head.
"Oh, Trouble!"
wailed Rhea, still flanked by the Ghoulians. With a final piercing whistle, the Merlin lifted his head as high as he could, then plunged his beak right into the uttermost heart of the blackness. Suddenly, a thin edge of bright light surrounded the grappling pair. A strange sucking sound rent the air, as if the wall separating two worlds had been ruptured. Both the dark mass and the hawk it had consumed grew swiftly smaller, until only a tiny black speck remained hovering in the air. An instant later, that, too, disappeared. Trouble was gone. Though he had somehow taken Rita Gower with him, I was as sure that the wicked spirit would one day return as I was sure that my friend would not. My sightless eyes brimming with tears, I bent to pick up a lone feather that had come to rest on the floor by my feet. I slowly twirled the banded brown feather between my fingers. It was from one of Trouble's wings, the same wings that had borne me aloft not so long ago. Those wings, like myself, would never fly again. Gently, I slipped the feather into my satchel. Suddenly, the point of a sword pushed at my chest. I looked up to see Stangmar, half his face and neck smeared with blood, scowling at me.
"Now we will fulfill our promise," he declared.
and in the way it was meant to be done, so that when our friend returns, he will know beyond doubt where our loyalty lies.
No,
pleaded Rhea.
Don't do it. This is your chance to be a true king, don't you understand?
Stagmar snorted. Waste not your breath on such lies. He turned to the Gullians. Guards, throw him into the cauldron.
Chapter 38 Ancient Words. Instantly, the Gullians, not guarding Rhea, tramped across the hall, converging on me. Swords drawn, faces emotionless, they began marching me toward the Cauldron of Death. I did not even try to resist them. Whether from the loss of trouble or from the continuous shaking of the floor, my legs felt wobbly and weak. Moreover, even if my powers could have helped me now, I had no heart to try any more. My only thoughts were of the empty place on my shoulder. Rhea tried to run after me, but the soldiers restrained her. Grimly, Stangmar watched. He stood as rigid as a statue, his eyes smoldering, his hand squeezing the hilt of his sword. The dried blood on his face had turned the same color as the blighted lands of his realm. Pace by pace, the procession drew nearer to the cauldron. It seemed to glower at me as I approached, dark and silent as death itself. For a moment I considered throwing myself into it willingly, in the hope that I might be able to destroy the cauldron as well as myself. But even that small satisfaction would not be mine, for the Gullians were flanking me so closely that they would surely have killed me before I broke free. Crestfallen, I turned to Rhea. Reaching through a gap between two of the soldiers, I extended a bent forefinger toward her. Although her eyes were clouded, she returned the gesture, symbolically wrapping her finger around mine for the last time. The Gullian stopped just short of the cauldron. Although it reached only up to my waist, its iron mouth yawned so wide that a fully grown man or woman could easily have fit inside. And within that mouth lay only blackness, even thicker and deeper than the shroud. The Gullians shoved me almost to the cauldron's rim, then turned to Stangmar, awaiting his orders. Rhea pleaded with the king,
"Don't, please!"
Stangmar paid no attention. His voice rising above the rumble of the ever-spinning castle, he gave his command. "Into the cauldron!"
At that instant, a tiny figure dashed out of the shadows near the stairwell. With only a fleeting glance at Rhea and myself, Shim sped across the floor, his small feet slapping on the stones. Before the Gullians realized what was happening, he clambered up to the rim of the cauldron. He hesitated for a fraction of a second, then threw himself into its mouth. A thunderous explosion shook in the hall, rocking the revolving castle to its very foundation. Although the spinning never ceased, the power of the blast caused the rotations to wobble erratically. I tumbled to the floor, as did Rhea and several of the Gullians. Torches fell from their mountings, sizzling on the stones. The flowering harp swayed precariously from the wall, held by a single string. As the sound of the explosion reverberated among the walls as well as the dark hills beyond, I regained my feet. What I saw was the Cauldron of Death split into two great halves. And there, in the center of the destroyed cauldron, lay the body of the little giant.
Shim!
I bent over my companion, tears again filling my eyes. My voice a mere whisper, I spoke to the corpse.
You always wanted to be big, to be a true giant. Well, a giant you are, my friend, a giant you are.
What treachery is this? Stangmar slashed his sword through the air as he raged at the Gullians. We told you to find any other intruders.
Angrily, he grabbed one of the Gullian swords and thrust it straight into the soldier's belly. The Gullian shuddered, but did not utter any sound. Then he slowly pulled the sword out again, facing Stangmar as if nothing had happened.
Stangmar strode up to me, still kneeling at the edge of the shattered cauldron. His face taut, he raised his sword high above me. As I turned toward him, my head tangled with black hair so like his own, he hesitated for an instant.
"Curse you, boy! The sight of you, and the cut of that cursed blade, has awakened feelings in us. Feelings we thought we had forgotten and wish only to forget again. And now our task is twice as wretched. For though we must do what we must do, the pain will be all the greater."
Suddenly, Stangmar's mouth dropped open in astonishment. He faltered, stepping backward in fright. From within the remains of the cauldron, a strange thing was happening. As if a gentle breeze had started to blow through the hall, the hairs on Shim's head were stirring, quivering. Slowly at first, then with increasing speed, his nose started to grow larger, then his ears, then the rest of his head, neck, and shoulders. His arms, too, began swelling, followed by his chest, hips, legs, and feet. His clothes expanded with him, growing larger by the second. Then came the greater miracle. Shim opened his eyes. More amazed, perhaps, than anyone else, he groped at his expanding body with his swelling hands.
I is getting bigger!
By the time Shim's head was pushing against the ceiling, Stangmar recovered his senses.
"It's a giant!" he cried to the Guliants. "Attack him before he ruins us all!"
The nearest Guliant dashed forward and ran his sword into the part of Shim's body that was closest. That happened to be his left knee.
"Oh!" howled Shim, clutching his knee. "Sting dead by a bee!"
Instinctively, the once little giant curled himself up into a ball. This only made him an easier target, however. The Guliants gathered around, poking and stabbing him with the fury of an angry swarm. Meanwhile, Shim's body continued to expand, with no sign of slowing. Before long, the pressure of his shoulders and back against the ceiling made it start to buckle. Chunks of stone rained down on us. A hole opened in the ceiling. One of the towers on the battlements fell, crashing into Shim's still-growing nose. But instead of making him curl up tighter to escape harm, the blow made something else happen. It provoked his wrath.
"I is angry!" he thundered, swinging his fist, now nearly as large as the king's throne, through a section of wall.
Stangmar, visibly frightened, started backing away. Following his lead, the Guliants also retreated. The two Finchiron men, who had been cowering by the throne, dashed madly for the stairs, tripping over each other in their haste. I ran to join Rhea, pausing only to retrieve Deepercut, which lay near the stairwell. Together we huddled in a far corner that seemed safe, for the moment at least, from falling stones. Then, for the first time in his life, Shim had a very giant-like experience. He saw his attackers running away from him, and the gleam in his enormous pink eyes made it clear that the experience was one he just might enjoy.
"I is bigger than you," he bellowed. "Muchly bigger!"
Shim, whose hairy feet alone had swelled bigger than boulders, stood up. He stretched his body to its fullest height, bringing down another piece of the ceiling. With a vengeful grin spreading over his gargantuan face, he began stomping on the Guliants. Each of his stomps shook the entire castle, and sections of the floor itself began to give way. But the deathless soldiers survived even these crushing blows. After each attack, they merely stood, shook themselves, and resumed slashing at Shim's feet with their swords. Shim's eyes flamed with rage. He stomped harder than ever. The more the Guliants scurried beneath him, the more weight he threw into every step. As I sat with Rhea in the corner, fervently hoping that Shim would not move to our end of the hall, I watched crumbling pieces of the ceiling crash around him. He was clearly angry, and clearly enjoying himself. Then, beyond the sound of splintering stones and stomping feet, I began to hear a strange rhythmic sound coming from somewhere beyond the castle. distant at first, then closer. The sound swelled steadily. I suddenly realized that it was the sound of voices, the deepest voices I had ever heard. They were singing a simple chant consisting of three profoundly low notes. And there was something else about the chant, something familiar, that stirred in me a feeling I could not quite identify. Then an enormous face, craggy as a cliff and wearing a shaggy red beard, appeared in the gap in the ceiling. It was followed by another with curly gray hair and full lips, and another with skin as dark as a shadow, a long braid, and earrings made from chariot wheels. Each of them nodded in greeting to Shim, but remained outside the castle walls.
"Giants," said Rhea in wonderment. "They have come."
Indeed, rising from their secret hiding places all across Finkyra, the giants had come. Responding to some long-awaited call, perhaps the explosion from the Cauldron of Death, they had lumbered out of the darkened canyons, remote forests, and unknown ridges of this land. Bearing huge flaming torches, they arrived from many directions. Some wore heavy nets of stones, which would have allowed them to rest unnoticed in fields of boulders. Others still carried branches, even whole trees, on their flowing manes. And others, perhaps because they were too foolish or too proud to disguise themselves at all, wore vests and hats and capes as colorful as the fruited trees of Druma Wood. Swiftly, the giants arranged themselves in a circle around the castle. Following Shim's example, they began stomping the ground together with the combined force of an earthquake. All the while, they lifted their voices in the rhythmic chant, singing in their most ancient language, the language of Finkyra's first people.
Higa dodin katenhu, huta kledri malwithan, gain ke ai beclown one kabri, varigal doan Finkyra, dravia, dravia, Finkyra.
In a flash, I recalled hearing my mother sing the very same chant. But was that memory from our time in Gunith, or from some time before? Had I perhaps even heard it as a baby? I could not quite tell. Somehow I caught the feeling, perhaps from that vague, uncertain memory, that the meaning of this chant had something to do with the timeless bond between the giants and Finkyra, with the notion that as long as one lasted, so would the other. Dravia, dravia, Finkyra. Live long, Finkyra. The more the giants danced by the light of their great torches, the more the castle crumbled. While the stones behind Rhea and me continued to hold, other sections of the wall were buckling. And as the castle's walls weakened, so did its enchantment. The spinning started to slow, the rumbling to fade. Then, with a grinding scrape of stone against stone, the castle came to a wrenching halt. Pillars and arches collapsed, filling the air with dust and debris. At that moment, the Ghoulians, whose power had sprung from the turning castle itself, released a unified shout more of surprise than of anguish, and dropped wherever they stood. I could not help but think, as I viewed their bodies sprawled among the stones, that their faces at last showed a touch of emotion, and that the emotion was something akin to gratitude. With the death of the Ghoulians, Shim climbed through a missing section of wall and joined the rest of the giants outside. As I listened to the pounding of their heavy feet all around the castle, I remembered more ancient words, words that had foretold this dance of the giants. Where in the darkness a castle doth spin, small will be large, ends will begin. Only when giants make dance in the hall shall every barrier crumble and fall. Shim, I realized, had been saved by an older form of magic. Older than the Shrouded Castle, older than the Cauldron of Death, older, perhaps, than the giants themselves. For even as his act of courage had destroyed the cauldron, his very footsteps in running across the stone floor of the hall had begun the dance that would destroy the castle in its entirety. Small will be large. Ends will begin. The Grand Elusa had told Shim that bigness meant more than the size of his bones. And now, through the bigness of his own actions, he towered above the battlements of this crumbling castle. Chapter 39. Home. The wall behind us started to groan. I turned to Rhea, whose tattered suit of vines still smelled of the forest.
"We must go, before the whole castle collapses."
She shook some chips of stone from her hair.
"The stairs are blocked. Should we try to climb down somehow?"
"That would take too long," I replied, leaping to my feet.
"I know a better way."
Cupping my hands around my mouth, I shouted above the din,
"Shim!"
Even as a crack split the wall, a face appeared through a hole in the ceiling. The face would have been familiar if only it had been many, many times smaller.
"I is big now," boomed Shim with pride.
"You got your wish, to be as big as the highliest tree."
I waved to him to bend closer.
"Now put your hand through that hole, will you? We need a ride out of here."
Shim grunted, then thrust his immense hand through the hole in the ceiling. The hand came to rest on the floor beside us, though so near to a chasm that only one of us at a time could squeeze past to climb into Shim's palm. Rhea chose to go first. While she carefully worked her way around the chasm, I hefted Deepercut in my hand, although its silver hilt still felt cold from the clutch of Rita Gaur. The twin edges gleamed with a luster that reminded me of moonlight on the rolling surface of the sea. Suddenly, I remembered the treasures of Finkaira. They too must be saved. Whatever time remained before the final collapse of the castle, I must use it to find the treasures that had not already been destroyed by falling debris.
"Come on," called Rhea, holding onto Shim's thumb.
"You go first," I answered. "Send Shim back for me."
As she watched me worriedly, I cupped my hands and shouted toward the ceiling.
"All right, Shim! Lift!"
As Rhea rose through the ceiling, I placed Deepercut on the safest-looking slab of stone I could find. Immediately, I began prowling around the remains of the once cavernous hall, crawling over tumbled columns and the corpses of Gulliants, dodging falling chunks of stone, stepping over fissures snaking across the floor. I moved as swiftly and carefully as possible. All the while, beyond the groans and crashes of the castle, I could hear the ongoing pounding of the dance of the giants. In short order, I found the flowering harp with all but a few strings intact, and a glittering orange sphere that I guessed must be the orb of fire. Quickly, I carried them over to Deepercut and returned for more. Near the toppled red throne, I discovered my own staff, a treasure at least to myself. At the far end of the hall, I uncovered the half-buried Caller of Dreams, as well as the hoe that Hone had said could nurture its own seeds. All in all, I found only 6 of the 7 wise tools. After the hoe, I located the plow that tills its own field, although it proved almost too heavy for me to lift. Then I discovered a hammer, a shovel, and a bucket, whose powers I could only guess. Last of all, I turned up the saw that I knew from Hone's description would cut only as much wood as needed. Although part of the handle had been crushed by a huge chunk of stone, the tool remained usable. I had just deposited the saw with the other treasures when Shim's face reappeared through the hole in the ceiling.
"You must come," he thundered. "This castle is readily to fall in."
I nodded, though I still wished that I'd been able to locate the missing one of the 7 wise tools. Not knowing what it might look like had only made my task of finding it more difficult. Even so, as Shim lowered his great hand and I began loading it with the treasures, I occasionally paused to scan the hall for any sign of the 7th wise tool.
"Is you done yet?"
Shim bellowed impatiently.
"Almost.
I hurled the last of the objects, my staff, onto his palm.
Just one more minute while I climb on.
Quickly, called Shim. You might not have another minute.
Indeed, as he spoke, I felt the stones of the floor under my feet shift drastically. I started to climb onto his hand, giving a final glance to the hall. Just then I spotted, in the shadows behind a smashed pillar, something that made my whole body tense. It was not the missing wise tool. It was a hand groping helplessly, the hand of Stangmar.
"Comes on," Shim implored. "I can seize the ceiling about to fall."
For an instant, I hesitated. Then, even as a section of the ceiling came crashing down beside me, I turned and raced across the floor of the foundering castle. The crumbling of the walls, floor, and ceiling seemed to accelerate, as did the chanting and stomping of the giants outside. When I reached Stangmar, I bent over him. He lay chest down on the floor, the gold circlet still on his brow. A large slab of stone had fallen across his lower back and one of his arms. His hand, now clenched into a fist, had ceased groping. Only his half-open eyes revealed that he was still alive.
"You,"
he moaned hoarsely,
"have you come to watch us die? Or do you plan to kill us yourself?"
I gave my answer by reaching over and gripping the slab. With all my strength, I tried to lift it. Legs trembling, lungs bursting, I felt not even the slightest movement in the stone. As the king realized what I was doing, he eyed me with scorn.
"So you would save us now to kill us later?"
"I would save you now so you might live,"
I declared, though the floor beneath us started to sway.
"Bah! Do you expect us to believe that?"
Concentrating hard, I heaved, calling on all the powers within me. Perspiration slid down my brow, stinging my sightless eyes. At last, the slab budged just a little, though not enough to free Stangmar. Before I could try again, the floor burst open. The two of us tumbled into the darkness below, amidst the rising roar of the castle's final collapse. All at once, something broke our fall. Stangmar and I rolled together in a heap. At first, I had no idea what had caught us, except that it was far softer than stone. Then, as the light from the giant's torches returned, I viewed the ruins of the castle below us, as well as a familiar face above us, and I understood.
"I catches you," crowed Shim. "It is a goodly thing I has two hands."
"Yes,"
I replied, sitting in the center of his palm.
"A goodly thing."
The giant's enormous mouth frowned.
"The wickedly king is with you," he roared with rage. "I will eat him."
A look of terror filled Stangmar's face.
"Wait," I cried. "Let us imprison him, not kill him."
Stangmar gazed at me with astonishment. Shim growled again, scrunching his mountainous nose with displeasure.
"But he is bad, completely, totally, horribly bad."
"That may be true," I replied, "but he is also my father."
I turned and looked into the dark eyes of the man beside me.
"And there was a time, long ago, when he liked to climb trees, sometimes just to ride out a storm."
Stangmar's eyes seemed to soften ever so slightly, as if my words had cut almost as deep as the blade of deeper cut. Then he turned away. Shim set us down on a knoll of dry grass at the edge of the hill where the shrouded castle once stood so formidably. Then he stepped away, the ground shaking under his weight. I watched him sit down, propping his back against the hillside. He stretched his immense arms and gave a loud yawn, though not so loud as the snore that I knew would soon come. Seeing Rhea nearby, I left the crumpled form of Stangmar to join her. She stood looking westward, beyond the castle ruins, toward a faint line of green on the distant horizon. Hearing the crunch of my footsteps, she spun around. Her eyes, wide as ever, seemed to dance.
You are safe.
I nodded. As are most of the treasures. She smiled, something I had not seen her do for some time.
Rhea, am I mistaken, or is it growing lighter? You are not mistaken. The shroud is going the same way as the castle and the Gulians.
I pointed toward the giants who had ceased their chanting and stomping. Singly and in clusters of two or three, they were beginning to drift away from the ruins.
Where are they going?
To their homes.
To their homes, I repeated.
Peering across the hillside, we observed what was left of the shrouded castle. While much of it had been crushed in the dance of the giants, a ring of mammoth stones remained standing in a stately circle. Some of the stones stood upright, while others leaned to the side, and still others supported hefty cross pieces. Whether the giants had placed the stones in this fashion or had simply left them standing, I knew not. In silence, as the first rays of sunlight started piercing the sky above the dark hills, I contemplated this imposing circle. It rose like a great stone hedge upon the land. It struck me that this ring of stones would make a lasting monument to the fact that no walls, however sturdy, can forever withstand the power of what is true. Vision that is true. Friendship that is true. Faith that is true. All of a sudden, I realized that I could remember my own childhood in this very place, on this very hill. Only when giants make dance in the hall shall every barrier crumble and fall. The prophecy I now understood had not applied only to walls of stone, my own inner walls that had cut me off from my past since the day I washed ashore on Gunith had begun to crumble along with those of the castle. First in gentle wisps, then in surging waves, memory after memory came floating back to me. My mother, wrapped in her shawl before a crackling fire, telling me the story of Hercules. My father, so confident and strong, leaping astride a black stallion named Ian. The first time I ever tasted Larkon, the spiral fruit. The first swim in the river unceasing. The final sorrowful minutes before we fled for our lives, my mother and I, praying that the sea might somehow deliver us to safety. And then, from my distant childhood, came the words of a chant called the Chledra. It was a chant that had been sung by my mother long ago, just as it had been sung by the giants themselves today. Talking trees and walking stones, giants are the island's bones. While this land our dance still knows, Varigal crowns Finkaira. Live long, live long, Finkaira. Rhea, I said quietly, I've not yet found my true home, nor am I sure that I ever will. But for the very first time, I think I know where to look. She raised an eyebrow.
And where is that?
I waved toward the circle of stones, luminous in the swelling rays. All this time I've sought my home as though it could be found somewhere on a map. And now I remember a home that I once knew, here, on this very spot. Yet, at the same time, I have the feeling that if my true home exists anywhere, it isn't on a map at all. More likely, it's somewhere inside of myself. Her voice wistful, she added, in the same place that our memories of trouble are found. I reached my hand into my satchel and pulled out the feather. Softly, I stroked its edge with my finger. I have an idea of what happened to him when he vanished. I can't quite believe it, but I can't quite dismiss it either. Rhea studied the feather.
I have the same idea, and I think Arbasa would agree.
If it's true, and his bravery opened the door to the other world, then he and Rita Gower must have fallen through that door together. She smiled.
It wasn't a journey Rita Gower had planned, but it gave us the chance we needed. So if it's true, trouble is somewhere out there right now, still soaring.
And Rita Gower is out there, too, still fuming.
She nodded. Then her face turned serious.
Still, I'm going to miss that hawk.
I dropped the feather, watching it spin slowly downward into my other hand.
So will I.
Rhea kicked at the brittle grass under our feet.
And see what else we have lost. This soil is so parched, I wonder whether it will ever come back to life.
With a slight grin, I announced, I already have a plan for that.
You do?
I think the flowering harp, with its power to coax the spring into being, might be able to help.
Of course, I should have remembered.
I plan to carry it to every hillside and meadow and stream that has withered, as well as to one particular garden, down on the plains where two friends of mine live.
Rhea's gray-blue eyes brightened.
I was even hoping...
What?
That you might want to come along. You could help revive the trees.
Her bell-like laughter rang out. Whether I come or not, this much is clear. You may not have found your true home, but I think you have found a few friends.
I'd say you're right.
She watched me for a moment. And one thing more. You have found your true name.
I have?
Yes. You remind me of that hawk who once sat on your shoulder. You can be fierce as well as gentle. You grab hold with all your strength and never let go. You see clearly, though not with your eyes. You know when to use your powers. And you can fly.
She glanced toward the circle of stones, gleaming like a great necklace in the light. Then turned back to me.
Your true name ought to be Merlin.
You can't be serious.
I am.
Merlin. I rather liked the name. Not enough to keep it, of course, though I knew that names sometimes had a strange way of sticking. Merlin. An unusual name, to say the least, and all the more meaningful because of the sorrow and joy it brought to my mind. All right, I shall try it, but only for a while.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged Listening Library production. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1996 by T.A. Barron. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.